This is the Working Drummer Podcast, featuring conversations with ground-level pros from all styles and regions. Real drummers with real stories about making a living in music.
Hey everyone, welcome to Working Drummer Podcast. I'm Zach Albetta, and this week I'm talking with Tom Jorgensen. For the past year and a half, Tom has been on the first national tour of the Beetlejuice Broadway musical. He also played on the first national tour of Waitress and some cruise ship work before that. When he isn't traveling, he's based in New York doing freelance live and recording work. He came to New York at age 18 to attend the New School, where he spent all 4 years studying privately with Michael Carvin. We have tons of Patreon content for you to check out, and you can get access to it all for a buck a month. Matt and I are doing monthly installments of the two of us just catching up about recent guests and whatever else. Q Robinson surprised me on the last one. That was a lot of fun. And our old buddy Matt Iceman is contributing some video content. As always, there are video lessons, transcriptions, and bonus interview content from our former guests as well. Once again, a donation of $1 a month gets you access to everything at patreon.com/workingdrummer. So Tom and I first met in San Diego not long after I started on Ain't Too Proud and he started on Beetlejuice. We hooked up again recently after my tour ended and his came through Atlanta. And after that, I was like, it's time to get this guy on. He's a great hang and a great drummer with his head on straight. So here you go. Hope you dig. Tom Jorgensen. So you're on a break right now. Is this about the halfway mark for you?
I don't know how to gauge that just yet. Yeah.
Does the tour have an end date?
As far as we know, that it's the end, but that's the dates that we have are just until next July. I believe Next July is when, at least publicly, that's when it's wrapping up. So.
Right. So you started Beetlejuice like right around the time I started Ain't Too Proud in the late fall of 2022.
Yeah, October is when I started New York rehearsals. Yeah.
Right, right. So this is like maybe a little more than the halfway point, but we saw each other in Atlanta recently and you were saying how it had been a while since you had a break.
Yeah. This is our first company-wide layoff since first week of July of last year. Man. So granted, I did take a vacation and I had a weekend off where I went to a wedding, but other than that, it's been go, go, go.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. So how's your mind? How's your body? How's your whole self?
I'm glad you're asking me this now that I'm on a break.
Right.
It's great. I was just mentioning a second ago, even to some friends of mine, that this really feels like a break. Even on a vacation, it was like, you know, you still have to plan stuff for your vacation. You still have to do this and that and that and this. And so I tried to go to a place where I didn't have to plan a whole lot. And it still wasn't, you know, wasn't as turning off as I wanted to. But this absolutely feels like... Yeah, it feels like I'm able to turn off now because I'm at home and this is my apartment and I see my friends and I don't really have to think about going anywhere or doing anything unless I want to. And then I just, so it feels like a break. I'm reinvigorated. I feel better. My body doesn't feel like it's going to, you know, die. But yeah, man. No, it feels good.
Have you dealt with any sort of acute physical issues over the course of it so far? Or is it just kind of normal fatigue, wear and tear?
Thankfully the latter. Thankfully just, you know, some normal fatigue. At least I think is normal. I'm always scared to death of, you know, either like the carpal tunnel or the tendonitis or stuff like that. So I try a lot of things to make sure, you know, as we all can get better, I could certainly get better at, you know, warming up in more efficient ways or, you know, getting my heart rate up. We've talked about this. And I caught your Dave Elitch interview on your recent episode. And so that kind of stuff, I really take to heart. So thankfully, no, but it's, you know, I do get tired. It's a very physical show. So my arms get tired, especially like my, under forearms get tired. My wrists get a little bit tired. Especially when I have, from the last tune of the show to bows and then to the exit music, it is just a straight, I mean, it's like a 200 yard dash, which is like one of the worst things to run. Cause like, you know, a 100 yard dash is like, you know, it's just a sprint to the finish, but a 200 is like just that extra long where it's like, oh my God, is this over yet? Is this over yet? But it's like, you still have to go. And so
yeah,
at the end of that, like the whole show, I'm fine. And then up until that point, then I sometimes go away with like, my hands feel a little like I overdid it, that I overdid that right. one, but. Yeah.
I was lucky on Ain't Too Proud because the really physically demanding parts of that show were not at the beginning or the end.
Nice.
Like the show, you know, at the beginning it kind of eased into it. It started off with a little bit of a bang with the way you do the things you do, but nothing really serious. So even if I wasn't feeling like 100% at the beginning of the show, it's like, okay, I can ease into this. And then
nice.
The last big number that's really demanding was Cloud Nine, which was like towards the end of the second act, but not the very end.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, but I'm, you know, listening to other shows and sort of researching other shows and there are a lot that it's like, whoa, it like either it starts off with a bang and doesn't stop for a while, or the end is like you said, just a sprint to the finish, or both.
Our show is kind of an amalgamation of everything that you had just said, because the show opens, there's like a prologue before our like main opening number basically, the prologue basically, so we start and it's a bit of a bang a little bit, but it's like, for me, it's maybe 10 measures, so I'm like getting the show going, and then all of a sudden I do a cymbal roll a couple measures later, and then I'm out until I think it's like maybe a minute and a half, 2 minute break while there's like ballad going on at the opening of our show. And so, like I'm getting my heart rate up and like, ready, let's do it. Let's start the show. Okay. I got a couple measures and then, oh, that's it for a while. Right. Okay. And then I'm just kind of sitting there going, okay. And
stay up. Yep.
Okay, great. Now we can go. And you know, right, and then thankfully, right. like the opening number is like, in fact, my favorite number of the show. It just kicks everything cool. off. And it's like, you know, even after 500 plus shows now, like I'll still play that number and just be like, just think to myself, man, I love this job. So I'm just very thankful for that alone. So that gets me, going.
Yeah. Yeah. So like, what is the stylistic ground that this show covers?
Yes. The question, the answer is yes.
Yes, and
yes. What was really cool about the way that the music was written for the show was that stylistically, Eddie Perfect wrote the music and lyrics, orchestrations by Chris Kukul. They wrote the music to reflect the character's personality. So it's all within the style of that character. So we have you know, Miss Argentina in act two, and it's a big heavy salsa Latin number. Lydia, our teenage emotional teenage you know, the daughter in the show,
right.
She has a pop punk number. It's like very pop punk. It's like, you know, kind of dead but open drums kind of thing. And then then we have a stereotypical musical theater couple that are just kind of happy-go-lucky, and it's just very like, you know, swingy, sing-songy. So it's all like the styles weave in and out. And then the coolest thing about that opening number, which is why it's pretty much my favorite, is that it weaves in and out of, I think, five or six different genre changes within the one number. It starts off with some ska, and then it goes to like some sing-songy Sesame Street kind of stuff mixed in with like heavy metal, like, you know, playing like double kick. And then it goes into like some more rock, and then some funk, and then some like Roma style music. And then a Sinatra portion where it goes into swing. And that's reflected on Beetlejuice's character quirks, where he's, you know,
right.
he's so bipolar, and he's zany, and he could be this way and that way, and then could be down, and then could be up again. And so it's in that way, it's like, it's so much fun to weave in and out of that. So it kind of employs all sorts of styles of music. So it's
right,
fun.
Right. And in terms of, like, you mentioned that first number is just going, like, in and out of every style, every few seconds, it seems like. Is a lot of the show like that? Because I guess what I'm getting at is I find a lot of modern musicals to be very ADD. Like,
yeah,
they switch gears often and fast.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes I think it serves the story or, you know, like you said, illustrates the character. But other times I'm just like, can y'all just decide on something and stick with it for a minute? Like,
yeah. Ours, yeah, from number to number, stylistically, they're so different. But mm-hmm. I think just in terms of orchestrations and the songs themselves, you could listen to any song and it'll be like a standalone song.
Right.
But within the story and within the scope of the show, it does weave itself together really, really well. So it's not like you're not hearing another number going, this is jarring or this takes me out or this is distracting. It just all very much, in my opinion anyway, and perhaps that's biased because I'm on the show. But I think I even remember watching it as an outsider before I even got the gig going, this is really cool. This doesn't take me out at all. This is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's what I like.
Another one of the things I really liked about Ain't Too Proud was that it pretty much stuck with a song. I mean, it's different because it's kind of a bio musical and you're dealing with the Temptations music and people sure. kind of expect to hear maybe not those entire songs, but like big chunks of them.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that we just like would stick with a song and then move to the next one and stick with that song. I was listening to, I interviewed about a year ago, I interviewed Mark Pardee when we were in Las Vegas.
Oh, cool.
And he's on the Moulin Rouge tour. And I wasn't familiar with that show at all. And after I interviewed him, I was like, let me check out this show. Let me see what it's about. And like, it's a jukebox musical and there are so many songs in it. Like each track on the cast recording has like, you know, it'll have the title of the track, but within that track, it'll move through three or four or five songs.
Yeah.
And I got into the third track and I had heard 20 songs and I was like, I can't, this feels like an ADD fever dream.
Yeah. I regrettably haven't checked out a lot of the show, maybe one or two tracks, but I'll do my due diligence at some point to check out more of that show.
Well, I mean, and this is another thing, like, you know, I'm relatively new to this world. I've played tons of musicals, but, you know, being on the Broadway tour circuit and kind of being up on what shows are currently on Broadway and what shows are about to go to tour, you know, I've been listening to things more, but I'm still not familiar with most of what's going on.
Yeah, it's hard to keep up with that, man.
One of the things I'm learning about, the Broadway thing and maybe the tour thing in particular is that there's not always an audition. Like sometimes they group, you know, a few names together and it's like, all right, all you three or four or five people submit a video audition. But other times, you know, either the musical director or the contractor or the music supervisor or all three of them will just agree on a person and say, hey, you, do you want the gig? So which way was this for you?
I've had kind of both of those experiences. This is my second Broadway tour. I was on the Waitress First National tour. I took over for Elena Bonomo, who is now doing Six on Broadway here in New York.
Oh, cool.
Dear friend of mine, and she was I'll start with that, because with Waitress, I was not even involved with the show at all when she took it out on the tour. And because we had been friends for, you know, a couple of years prior to that, we'd been giving each other gigs all the time, you know, stuff that we couldn't do. And she was always a very solid call. And I like to think that I was the same. You know, we would always get gigs that were very suited. We're pretty similar drummers and have the same sensibilities. And so she needed to take a week off from the tour and it was owed to her via vacation. And she couldn't get any of the Broadway subs, who are usually first in line to go out and cover. None of them were available to go out and cover. And so she was very gracious to throw my name in. So I was then put in touch with the music supervisor, Nadia DiGiallinardo. And she said, hey, could you learn a couple songs, put them on video, just so we could see, you know, what kind of player you are. And And then from those, they said, hey, okay, great. Everything sounds good. We'd love for you to come. This was when it was running on Broadway in New York at the time. And they said, we'd love to have you come in and do a show before you go out and cover, which I thought it was totally backwards. I thought, you know, you'd go out and do the tour and then you'd be like, oh, you got it. So you can now come do a show here in New York. But they were like, hey, we'd love to have you come in and do a show. And that was my Broadway debut.
Wow.
Yeah. So I came in and did the show and, you know, I had, you know, I was nervous as heck. Heart rate was, I didn't need any coffee that day. but then they saw how I played and then they were like, okay, everything sounds good. Go out and cover. And then even from then on, I'd covered that, that tour. And then when I came back to New York, they said, well, would you want to sub and keep subbing? So I did. And then I ended up taking over the tour in future time, like maybe a year or year and some change later. But then when it comes to Beetlejuice, there was no audition, but I was reached out to by actually a friend of mine. I was recommended. The music director was kind of put in charge of putting together the band because unfortunately, it was Howie Joynes who was our contractor, and he was sick at the time that he needed to contract the band. And so he asked Andy, he's like, oh, you know, if you know people, go ahead and start putting together your band. And Andy was looking for drummers. He had just hired the associate keys, assistant conductor. And next in line was drums because we needed to start New York rehearsals together. So drums were next in line and he was on the Lion King tour subbing at the moment at that current time. And so, Phil Martin was out, playing drums on that, still, you know, great guy. And I had met him doing, the Waitress First National tour. We overlapped in Toronto together. So we got to know each other and Phil very, very kindly recommended me to Andy, who's our music director. And so then Phil said, hey, here's his email. Send him some stuff if you're interested. And so I was on an overseas gig at the time. And so I spent the 12, 13 hour flight on the way back. I invested in the internet and I bought the internet and downloaded all my videos from like a reel and my resume and just updated it and was sending copies to like people down on the ground to be like, hey, does this look good? Does this look good? Is that good? Is that reading okay? These links open up and then sent Andy that email. And then within a couple of days, I got hired. So,
wow.
Cool. Yeah, it was very, very quick this time around. So it varies from job to job.
Yeah, it really is kind of not a crapshoot, but there's just there's no rules per se. There's no standard procedure as far as how these chairs get filled and when they get filled. A lot of times it's sort of like Q likes to say it's nothing and then everything. Like there's crickets
when it rains,
for weeks
it pours.
Or months, right? And then the machine kicks into gear on a day, and all of a sudden it's like shit. Got to send the thing. Got to make the video.
The thing that kind of is in common with all of most of these scenarios that I hear is like, you know, it's about who you know. You know, there was something to the degree of a saying of it's, you know, who you know gets you in the door and then what you know keeps you there.
Right.
It's something to that degree of like, you know, who you know gets you in the room and what you know keeps you in the room. And, you know, and so it's that kind of thing. It's exactly what we were just talking about of kind of being prepared for that, you know, if nothing is happening for a while, like, what are you doing within that time to keep yourself prepared for when something does happen? Because, you know, I'll regurgitate a million things from my mentor, Michael Carvin, who I studied with.
We're going to get to him.
Yeah. He had a saying that he learned from Papa Joe Jones, whom he studied with as a kid, which he would say all the time. He'd say all programs are subject to change at any given time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's just being prepared, you know, be prepared and then go with the flow.
Right, right. And you're absolutely right. It is about who you know. And like, I think I'm really trying hard to promote the idea of building and cultivating and maintaining relationships rather than the idea of like, it's all about who you know, or you got a network or whatever, because that like those can sound a little bit cynical. But if you talk about, you know, just building relationships with, you know, people you want to play with, people who make decisions, people who can put you in a position to step in and do well.
Yeah.
Those relationships are where it's at. You know, Q also likes to say, because, you know, Q is just becomes the mayor of whatever town he shows up in. He's like a magnetic personality.
Yeah.
He makes everybody feel great. And he's great at not only creating relationships for himself, but creating relationships between other people that he knows. Mm-hmm. And I've heard him say, like, some of his friends and colleagues kind of give him shit a little bit about, like, you know, you get the opportunities you get because you've got the gift of gab, right? It's this big personality of yours that kind of puts you in these chairs.
Sure.
And Q resents it a little bit because he's like, yes, I do have the gift of gab, but I still have to sit down and play the fucking drums.
Yeah.
Like, everybody could love me, you know, as much as they want, but if I can't deliver when I'm put in these positions.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's, you know, we talk a lot about, if you're introverted, you got to find a way to be a little bit extroverted sometimes and create those relationships. Yep. And it can be exhausting. But then the other side of that coin is with all the legwork you're doing socially, you have to make sure you're prepared musically and technically and all that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for me, there's an authenticity meter for that. And, you know, especially I'm deeply introverted. I very much recharge being by myself, having my alone time. And then, I expel my energy. I use my batteries out in public. So, you know, mm-hmm. in order to recharge, in order to go be social, I can do that. And I've learned how to do that. But to me, I find, especially when we're in the arts and when there is a thing called networking, yes, there is networking, but there's a thing that often gets turned off with the capital networking is that there's a level of inauthenticity with it. Mm-hmm. everybody could smell BS a mile away when somebody is just there to network. And right. It's like, okay, well, but that's, look, our product is relationships. Our product is being able to move people. Like, we are storytellers. We need to have a relationship with our audience in order for our art to live through us and through them by proxy. So we need to have good relationships within what we do. And so if your goal is just to get on a gig because you networked with somebody and they got you this and that without addressing the underlying thing of like, yeah, I can grab a beer with that guy, or yeah, we can go out to lunch and just talk about, I don't know, golf or basketball or, you know, any hobbies that you like doing. I mean, just relationships. There's, right. you know, you have to be authentic about it. And like that, just, you know, if you're not good with that, you should just meet more people and get good at that. Cause that's ultimately what it comes down to.
Has the show stretched you as a player? Like, were there some concepts, or whether it was technical or musical or whatever, that at the beginning of the show you were like, oh, I got to get my shit together in this area?
Yeah, definitely on the physical level. As the obvious answer that I can give right now, I mean, there's several more, but the obvious one was definitely a physical thing. Prior to this gig, I was not a very loud drummer. I still don't mm-hmm. consider myself a loud drummer. And in fact, that kind of has pertained to my entire philosophy of performing, of playing, that my philosophy is a very sound oriented approach. So I try not to think in terms of volume levels, because we are animated people. We're musicians. That comes with the territory. That's how we tell the story. But the common denominator of everything that we do is sound. I mean, this is what Carbon would say, you know, we live, this is the sound industry. This is the sound business, not necessarily the music business or, you know, the Broadway business. It's all comes down to sound. And so you can have a big sound and be, you know, playing at pianissimo and it'll fill every need that the music has versus if you're playing loud, but thin, and if that's what you want, cool. But the whole purpose is like, that's what you're going for. You have to have an intention. And if your intention is set out that way, but so to come back to this show, I needed to find a way to maintain a big sound while not, you know, because it does, you need to give the microphones the proper information for this show. And the, you know, if you don't have good technique and you just try to play loud, your sound ends up sounding a little bit more thin. You don't give the microphones the all of the information. Like, say if you're needing to hit a snare drum, you need to open up a lot of harmonic content to make that, you know, activate the bottom snares more. Something I was learning a lot from Shannon Ford, who played Beetlejuice originally in New York on Broadway. And he was so loud. Like he is a very aggressive player, but so tasteful, so musical. And so the first time I sat with him, I said, like, man, what, break down your mechanics here, because you're getting such a massive sound being over your shoulder. When 9 times out of 10, most drummers, when they play that loud, they end up choking the sound out of the drum, resulting in a thinner sound, resulting in not giving microphone what they need. And then it chokes the room, cancels other frequencies, and the sound, you know, funny enough, sounds quieter, right? You know, but he's getting a massive sound and he's like, you know, over the shoulder and like digging in, great posture, everything. And I'm like, what are you doing here? And he, you know, broke down a lot of things that he did technique wise, using more of the larger muscles instead of the smaller muscles for, you know, bigger passages, like, you know, have your body work for you instead of against you. And so, you know, it's things like that that really stretched me in this show, is learning how to, I wasn't used to hitting really hard or like having to, you know, get all of that out. And so, you know, I started working out. I started doing, you know, some stretching. I do stretches every night, about 20 minutes. I did like some, bought some program that helps you stretch some stuff, because my, you know, I'm chronically inflexible. And so just, you know, so stretching physically, you know, pun intended, yeah. That's what this show really started. You know, it was an immediate, obvious thing. Like, you need to get better in shape. You need to have your body, you know, help you. You need to help your body help you.
Right, right. It's interesting what you say about sound versus volume, because I experienced some of that on the ATP show and learned quite a bit about it, and found that, like you said, if you're getting like big muscles behind your movement and your hand and your stick are just kind of along for the ride, then like you can come down on a drum or a cymbal with more mass. Like, there's more mass in motion going into that instrument instead of velocity, right? Because you can get volume from like a really quick whippy velocity, and that creates a sharper sound. Sometimes, like you said, a distorted or thinner sound. But I found if I just like get those big, huge, you know, back muscles involved and just make the motion, you don't always have time to, you know, make those motions so huge. But when you do, like I was getting a fuller sound. I was not worried about cracking cymbals. It was like, it was slower, but heavier.
It's more relaxed. It's more open. Your groove then gets better. It's not tight, and like, it's so crazy. Like, Jeff Porcaro would even talk about this, and I love talking about this because it's so influential. Like, just having a sound based approach is so influential for so many things, because it's all cyclical. It all informs aspects of another. Like, Jeff Porcaro would talk about, like, he'd play the same groove with, like, you know, a snare that's a lower pitch that's like pretty similar to like the pitch where his kick drum is, or like at least you'd hear like a boom, 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 boom,
Right.
But then he'd change to like a piccolo snare drum, have a higher pitch, and he'd play exactly the same groove, exactly the same way. And the groove would then be different already. He didn't change anything about his time. I mean, he had impeccable time. So he didn't change anything. And he'd say, like, the groove is just different. Like, if you change the sounds of your drums. So then even your sound now is influencing how not only your music is heard, but how you're going to play it. I mean, we wouldn't take a piccolo snare drum to a stadium rock gig. You know, it just, I mean, if, unless you're, you know, 311 and made that appropriate for the music. Omaha represent. But, you know, but case in point, like if you're playing like a, you know, Say You, Say Me, Lionel Richie, like that's a deep stadium, you know, snare with extra long reverb. Like a piccolo snare drum would have sounded ridiculous on that, you know, so that would have influenced, you know, decisions being made in the room. Like, of course, they wouldn't choose that. So having that kind of approach is just, to me, one of the most important things that we do, you know, that would influence the groove, that would influence how my body then needs to react to drums. I mean, we all know how we get the sounds out of our drums, and then it influences our technique. You know, where you hold the stick will influence your ride cymbal sound, and how many fingers, you know, are you holding it with, you know, all of your fingers wrapped around, then you'd maybe get a dead sound because the stick isn't vibrating. But then if you're loose, then all of a sudden you hear more stick definition or more stick vibration. Like all of this influences everything. And so that being cyclical is like just kind of one of the coolest things ever, in my opinion.
Yeah. I think playing a Broadway show for as long as Broadway and touring drummers tend to do it, sort of you almost have no choice but to start obsessing about sounds, because at a certain point you're not really worried about the book anymore. Like you got to pay attention and keep your head on straight, but you know what you're doing. So now your attention starts to drift to like, oh, I never noticed, like you said, like the difference in that ride sound in that spot. Mm-hmm. Or so then you start looking for all these things. I remember, you know, speaking of Mark Party again, he talked about how at one point he started, there was like one number or one part of a number, since it was Moulin Rouge, that he's playing a cross stick. And at one point he realized like, oh, this maple stick sounds better on with that cross stick thing. So just for that one little part of that song, he switched his left stick to a maple stick so he could play that cross stick.
Man.
And you know, it's minutia. It's like, you know, maybe nobody notices. Maybe we're the only people who know or give a shit about that, but it keeps us engaged.
That's precisely the point, obviously. Because I, well, not obviously, but honestly, is that like people might not hear that out in the house. And a lot of people might argue, oh, you'd never hear that in the house. Why would you do that? Well, it's like, that is completely missing the point. It's like, we are storytellers. So whatever way that we feel that is authentic to how we are telling this story, it doesn't really matter if it doesn't reach the audience in the way that you hope it reaches. Because I mean, another saying that I really like is, you are not the audience, which is, you know, when you think about it, it's very obvious, but we are experiencing this show differently than the audience member, obviously. So, but to really put that into perspective is like, all of our decisions that we make here, hopefully, is what we want to transmit to the audience, and whether or not they receive that is not really the point. It's like, we are still authentically telling our story. And I'm like, oh, if I need to switch to a stick to tell this story better, I think my voice brings out something here. By us doing that, making that decision, it does influence the way the story is told, no matter how the audience receives it. But something will be different. Something will change within that. Even tuning snare drums or checking out different cymbals. Like, we have ways that we approach our instrument and our craft. And that in turn, you know, should we do it authentically within ourselves? Like, that's how we tell the story. So to me, apart from all of that is important. Yeah.
And apart from, you know, how the audience receives something or how the cast receives something, part of me is like, fuck them. I want to have a good experience doing this. Like, and figuring out the sounds that make me feel good is just like, not to be too prosaic about it, but if you find those sounds that make you feel good, that bubbles up to just this feeling of like, I'm happy to be here. I'm having a good time.
Yeah. You know, everybody loves playing on a good axe. Like, that's another thing too. Man. It's like, if you're playing on a Walmart kit, you know, it's probably not as fun unless you're into that kind of sound, great. And no fool, no fun. That's whatever. But you know, once you get behind, like, you know, I mean, it's kind of the fun thing about like electronic kits, you know, say what you will about electronic kits, but they're processed. They've got the reverb on there, and they're fun to play because they sound good and like, or, you know, give or take, they sound processed. They have that, that quality is like, oh, this sounds like straight from a record, or, you know, so when you get drums that just respond to you and you feel good playing them, like, that just then in turn influences how you play it and how you have fun. And then it all goes back and forth, round and round.
Yeah. So let's talk about Carvin. He's,
oh boy.
He's made numerous appearances on this podcast through the
fantastic,
you know, through the big family of disciples and pupils that he's amassed over the years.
So then I'm basically here, you know, I don't know what I'm doing here for. This is he probably covered everything, man.
No, I'm saying, like, he's never been on the podcast, but he's come up numerous times. He's played a role on this podcast.
Yeah.
Just talk about like how and when you came to New York and how you sort of entered Carvin's orbit there.
Sure. I moved to New York when I was 18. I graduated high school and I'd been auditioning to, you know, all the schools, Berkeley and New School, MSM, NYU, and New School was the one that I'd got into New School and I wanted to be in New York. And so I'm like, okay, well, New School's the route. And it's a bit of a smaller school. It's not, at the time, I think we had maybe max 280 students in the jazz institution. So that felt like the right fit. So I moved to New York, went to the New School. And through the New School, their curriculum offers, part of their program is lessons. You know, you get to, you know, take lessons with, you know, with a teacher. And so they give you 9 lessons per semester. When you get into the school, you're given a test, which is the proficiency test. And they test you on, you know, all things proficient. You know, drummers should be proficient in bass level, you know, your rudiments, certain techniques, playing different styles of music, you know, blah, 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 basics.
Reading, etc.
And yeah, and you know, so it, depending on how well you do in that test, you either placed out of proficiency, meaning you scored well enough to be able to choose your own teacher out of a list that they have of like adjunct faculty, or at least contracted through the school in order to teach through that program, or you're placed in proficiency where you're placed with a teacher in the New School faculty to work on those basics to then, you know, get you ready to then take the test again, and then you can score out of proficiency and choose your own teacher. It was kind of wild that I think I was the only one in the incoming freshman class that had scored out of proficiency that year. And I could be wrong, but to my knowledge, I was the only one, which I was baffled by, because they gave you the list of things to work on that summer. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, oh yeah, well, okay, then I'll just work on that. And then we get there and that they're testing us on the stuff that they had sent us. So, so I scored out of proficiency and was able to choose my own teacher. And this list was exhaustive. Like, it had, you know, everybody from Allie Jackson to Carl Allen up at Juilliard, or, Matt Wilson, Ari Honig was on this list. I mean, you name it. It was like every cat in New York.
Right, right.
And so I was so overwhelmed with this list, because a lot of these were my favorite drummers in different respects, like all on this list. And I'm like, oh, Jesus, I don't know what to do. So yeah. I called my teacher that was in Omaha, who had been a New York resident, New York drummer, played with like Norah Jones back in the day, played with Wynton and Branford and Sherman Irby on cruise ships. And, you know, he had a residency at Smalls. His name is Dana Murray. Runs a great organization out of Omaha now called NOMA. So those listening, check it out. It's a really, really cool thing. And if you're traveling through Omaha, be sure to check it out. They do jam sessions and all that. Anyway, nice. I called Dana up and I say, hey man, I don't have a single clue who to pick here. Like, I can study with Brian Blade, for Christ's sakes. Like, what do I do here? And he says, okay, read me off some names. I say, Carl Allen. He's like, yeah, oh, good, good. That'd be good. Matt Wilson. Yeah, yeah. Okay, cool. I think Obed Calvera, whom I saw you just interviewed. I think he was on that list. You know, Eric Harland. And he's like, oh yeah, yeah, some cats. Okay, great. And then I get to, and I say, and there's this guy, Michael Carvin. And then he just goes, stop reading me names. Just stop. He said, just don't consider anybody else. Just go to Carvin. And I said, well, I could split my lessons up. You know, we could choose to do like a 6 and 3, six with one teacher, 3 with another. And I was like, you know, I could do that. And he's like, you're going to want to do all 9.
Wow.
And so I did. My first semester, I took all 9 with him. My second semester, I took all 9 with him. And for all 4 years, I studied with Carvin for all 9 lessons every semester.
Wow.
Because, you know, at that point, it was like I was already studying what guys were doing, and I was working on technique and stuff on my own time. And then what Carvin was teaching, I just had this feeling that like I couldn't really get that anywhere else. So I was like, you know, I'll maximize what I got from Carvin. So I studied with him all 4 years of college. And then as soon as I got out of school, we maintained in touch, and he's still been a huge mentor to my life. So anytime I'm struggling or have questions or something, I'll call him and he'll just set me straight. We'll be on the phone for an hour and a half, 2 hours, and he'll just let me have it. And it's like, oh, yeah, you're right. Got it. Cool.
Yeah. 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 So like, where did you start with him, and where did he take you, and how did he get you there?
Man. So a prime example of how Carvin teaches is, where we started was, he sat me down, and basically what he does with every student is, he calls you on the phone once, or you call him once he has to approve you to study with him. So I got in touch with him, and even over the phone, he said, sing me a triple Rademacue. And I'd sing it, and then he'd say, okay, tell me the sticking of a triple Rademacue on the phone. Like, this, we hadn't even scheduled a lesson yet. And then he'd say, okay, get a pen and paper, and I'll give you the details of the lessons. And he'll say, I'll know when you have a pen and paper in front of you. He's like, don't jot it on your phone. Don't say, yeah, I got it. It's like, pen and paper. You know, because his thing was, until men take pen in hand, they'll never be successful. So everything we did was, no recorders in the lessons. You know, everything was pen and paper. You write stuff down. And so going over those basics, then we talked about putting the kit together as fits like how our ergonomics are. I mean, people are taller and shorter, and so in order to build the kit, in a way that has our body working for us, was one of the things. But apart from that, like, he hits every student with like the end all be all of existential questions, which is, what is your number one dream? Like, what do you want to do in your life? Like, what is your goal? If your dream can come true, what would that dream be? And usually that shocks people because they haven't been, you know, totally aware of like what their total dream is. They have things that they want to do. And I was like kind of, you know, frozen in my seat. And he says, I'll never forget this. He says, I can't teach you shit how to play the drums, but what I will do is lead you to yourself. Cause once a person knows themselves, they'll conquer the world. And I'm just like frozen in my seat going, God damn.
<You're> 18.
I'm 18 years old. I'm like, okay, well, I just got out of high school, man. Like, I don't like I had some bands that I was like, you know, on a list of like, oh man, I would love to, you know, like Robert Perkins with Michael Bublé's band. I was like, ah, oh, man, I would love that gig. That'd be great. So, you know, talked about like those kinds of things. And then he'd say, okay, you have to define your why. You have to define what it is that you want to do and why you would want to do it. And from there, I could lead you to that. I can lead you to how you go about this. And that within that, you become more in tune with yourself. And so that's ultimately what he ended up doing. So we spent a lot of lessons talking about sound. We were very, you know, I adapted my sound philosophy based on his foundational setting of, you know, what we do with our instrument. So he taught me a lot of things on just how to think for myself and how to build, you know, my own voice, you know, because one of my questions to him early on was, you know, how do I find my voice? We all need to find our voice. And he said, shut up. Like, you already have one. Like you just have to craft it. You already have one. So like, you don't need to find it anywhere. You've got it. If you know what you like and what you don't like, you can find ways to tune that and you can find ways to have that live through you and through your craft. That's your voice already. And he would show me his thumbprint. He'd say, everybody's got one of these. You know, everybody's got a fingerprint and it's unique. So even if you're playing the same thing as so-and-so, it's not about what you're playing. It's about what you're doing. Because hopefully what you're playing next week isn't what you're playing today anyway. So it does, you know, it's about what you're doing. And so even with our own uniqueness, we could play similar things, similar vocabulary as other guys. But if we're not doing something different, then, you know, that's the cake there. So he took me through all that. And then, you know, we would decide on like a gig and then he'd tell me the blueprint of, you know, how to follow up and how to get gigs, how to meet people, you know, all these things. So, you know, from there, it just kind of sets up life.
Interesting you talk about sort of finding your voice and him leading you to yourself. Because I certainly didn't study with him once a week for 4 years, but I did take a few lessons with him. He would come to Kansas City when I was in grad school there, I got a little bit of experience with him. And you're reminding me of this lesson I had with him where I was in the big band. The big band was led by Bobby Watson.
Cool.
And we were doing, he was my grad school mentor. So, we were doing a big band arrangement of one of Bobby's tunes that he did with Horizon called Limoncello. And you know, Victor Lewis is the longtime drummer in Horizon and just, you know, Bobby's longtime go-to guy. And Victor Lewis played it, you know, pretty straight ahead swing. Like it's a little bit of a funky kind of Horace Silver flavored tune. And, you know, so I, like Carvin could tell that I wanted to do something different. Like he heard me play it and he heard me just sort of like mess around with a funkier, not halftime, but just a funkier, greasier, less bebop thing. And he was like, you're not playing this song the way you want to play it. And I said, yeah, I'm not. He said, you want to play it funkier, don't you? And I said, yeah, I do. But, you know, Victor on the record, like he didn't play it that way. And he just said, fuck Victor Lewis.
Yep.
And he said, Victor Lewis is not the drummer in the UMKC big band. You are.
Kaboom. Yep.
Bobby trusts you in this chair. Mm-hmm. Like, do what you want to do. And if it doesn't work for the song, Bobby will tell you, but be you. You know, don't let what Victor Lewis did prevent you from doing what you want to do.
Yeah. Huge lesson. Huge lesson. Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's served me in a number of stages of my life. Cause like, you know, how many times do we step in after another drummer? Right.
Lots. Like,
if you're, you know, if you're subbing temporarily, you got to toe the line and whatever, but you know, whether it's a Broadway musical or a band or whatever, like sometimes we just take the baton from another drummer and the chair is ours now. And, you know, I've been, I guess it's kind of a combination of me having the confidence to make those chairs my own, but also having the trust of my bosses, you know, whether it was a singer-songwriter or the MD on a Broadway show, to make it your own. Like they're not going to micromanage you. They're going to say, you know, I've hired this guy for a reason. He has a voice. He has ideas. I'm going to let him do them.
That's the goal. Sometimes it doesn't happen that way. But that's the ideal scenario. And thankfully I have that, at Beetlejuice. And that was, a really big thing that I in turn wanted to do with this show is, Shannon played it brilliantly. There were a lot of things that worked for him that didn't work for me, musically speaking. But the key to finding out how to make a show yours is to find out what is appropriate first.
Yep.
It's like when you shed a book, it's not just about, and I tell, you know, some students that either come watch me or, you know, some people wanting to get into this business or wanting to do musical theater or stuff. I tell this a lot where it's like, you know, if you're learning a book, it's not necessarily that you're just learning the notes, the ink on the page. Like, yeah, that's the vocabulary and that's the, you know, what you're playing, but then it's what Carvin was saying, it's about what you're doing. And when you're studying a new book, even if you're taking it over or if you're building it the first time, it's like you find quickly what is musically appropriate for the tone of the show. You mm-hmm. find that this feel like I would never be able to do a, like I'd never be able to do that fill in Beetlejuice and a heavy metal number. That fill is not musically appropriate for the tone. Like certain fills I would not be able to do because I've understood, I've done my homework, I've done research into hearing how Shannon interpreted the book and what was musically appropriate. But then some stuff I'd say, well, I could do this fill that Shannon doesn't do, but I feel in my bones that this is musically appropriate that I can contribute. And so then you find that that's how you end up making a book yours. It's like, it may not be verbatim what they're doing, but you are still within the spirit of that, of what they're doing.
Yes, totally.
You know, you find the spiritual fingerprint, if you will.
right. And, you know, we're talking specifically.
Coin that.
Spiritual fingerprint. Hey, now.
Yeah.
We're talking specifically about musical theater, but I think this really applies in so many different situations. Like, you
100%.
Know, if you're coming into a band, like a well-established band, after another drummer, you know, you don't necessarily have to sound exactly like that drummer and play all the fills the way he did, or even use the same tones in the drums and cymbals, but you do have to figure out like what just the nature of that music is and what you want to do that fits within that scope. And what you also got to be honest about things you would want to do that do not fit the character of the music or the show or the song or whatever you want. There are multiple right ways to play almost everything.
But at the same time, there is no right way. You know, it all works together. And that's a crazy thing too, is like, you know, you could take over for a drummer on a well-established band. And, you know, one thing that we were talking about too, is like, everybody could smell BS. I was taking a course at New School. It was, dissecting records. And I I can't remember his name, and I hope he'll forgive me if he even hears this, but he was the president and CEO of Nonesuch Records. I'll think of his name tomorrow afternoon when I'm not in this interview, but but he taught, one of the first things he talked about as a record executive giving music to an audience, it says never underestimate your audience ever. Because they will smell BS from a mile away if you're not authentic. And that goes with what we're saying here is, like, if you get a drummer that takes over for a band or something that then tries to emulate and is not authentic to themselves as a player, the audience is going to go, dude, he's just trying to sound like XYZ. Mm-hmm. Like, they can hear that. They can hear inauthenticity, and they can hear that this isn't happening. And then on the other side of the coin, you get a drummer that people would be like, oh my God, why is he even in this band? He's not musically appropriate. But then he'll do some things that'll really start making you think, go like, oh, he's inventing a new vocabulary. He's doing something different, but somehow it's appropriate. Mm-hmm. And like, that's the mark of, like, you know, when people are really, you know, really at a musical level, that they've worked on a craft to be, you know, so unabashedly themselves that, you know, if they're trusted with a gig and they come in and they know themselves enough to be like, hey, I've got something really cool in mind. Let's check this out. If this doesn't work, okay, cool. But I'm going to try it out because this is me.
Right.
And then people will hear some new stuff. And of course, you'll get the people that are divided. You know, you'll divide the crowd of like, ah, no, that's going in a new direction that I don't like. But then you'll have some people that are like, I've been a fan of this band for years, and this is a new sound that I think is revolutionary, and it's revitalizing the sound of this band. So there are lots of right ways to play things, and then there's no right way to play it. So it's just, it's so cool. I love that kind of stuff.
And against that, you have to balance, like, in addition to sort of knowing the character of the music and what's going to be appropriate or inappropriate, I think you have to kind of read the room of the situation you're walking into and assess, like, how much myself can I be? Is being 100% myself going to scare them off? How important is it to me? And, you know, because the reason I bring it up is, like, in order to get the Ain't Too Proud gig, I had to be a carbon copy of Q. Like, in order for everybody to just be comfortable with Q leaving and you know, X dude coming in, it was in my best interest to just show everybody, look, this is going to be an easy transition.
But we're all telling the story together. So reading the room is very much a part of it too. It's like, you know, there's a story being told here and we're all doing it together. So I can't just be the one telling a story and saying, fuck everybody else. It's like, no. Okay. I got to listen to what people are saying and then adapt accordingly, you know, and I'm just the conduit to help do that. And, you know, so we're all on the same page. Hopefully that's the goal, is to get on the same page.
When I was in the process of putting together my video audition, I was talking to my brother, who is not in the music world, but he's a very intuitive dude. And I was telling him how, like, I was putting these videos together. I was kind of sending some stuff to Q, saying, like, what do you think of this? How does this sound? And Q was putting me through it. He was like, it's not enough. You need more energy. You need more command. It's not enough. It's not enough. So I was telling my brother about this and how I was getting a little frustrated and impatient. And he was like, I think what Q is saying is, like, you don't want people to look at your video and say, yeah, I could see him doing this gig. You want people to look at your video and say, oh, he's doing it.
that's our guy. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that doesn't necessarily mean you have to be a carbon copy of someone like I was in that situation, but just having the confidence, the command, and the awareness of the situation to just walk in and own that music and that gig. It's something I'll never forget, really. And it came from you know, the unlikely source of my my brother who works at Freedom Mortgage.
It's all love. We all want to succeed. I think that's ultimately the bigger picture to what we do, and that's why relationships are so important. Is, you know, there will always be some friendly competition. You know, people want gigs that other people have, but in the end, I was talking with a buddy of mine about this, and we were talking about just how much in terms of relationships go, when we have a relationship with somebody, we, a foundation of a good relationship is you hope the best for that other person. Yeah. So when you're dealing with guys that are drummers, other musicians, people that could take your gig, you know, it's like, it's, you don't even think about that at that point like that anymore. It's like, we in this community, and it's such a special community, that the whole point of this is that we all need to cheer each other on. Mm-hmm. We all need to be cheerleaders for each other. It'd be like, oh, so-and-so got that gig. Yeah, man, absolutely. Congrats on that. And then, you know, gone are the days of like being protective over, oh, well, I want that gig, so I'm not going to let this out or let that out. It's like, no, we share things. You know, I'll share technique stuff with other drummers. I'll share, hey, I'm working on this and you're working on that. Cool. Like, let's, oh, cool. Great. Awesome. Let's check that stuff out. And we're all in this together. And so the more that we root for each other and have each other's backs, that's where, you know, if you win, then I win, because I'm winning because you're winning. We're all, yeah. You know, that's how winners win.
It's a hard thing to do. I've struggled with it, especially when I was a younger drummer. And I think it's, younger drummers tend to struggle with that more, just in terms of gig envy, jealousy, being protective and territorial about shit, rather than viewing it as just this, it's kind of this round robin thing. And, you know, if you're, like you said, authentic and diligent about creating relationships, if you take care of business on the drums, like, Your turn will come around. It might take fucking forever. It might take way longer than you want it to. But if you're just in it in good faith with your fellow drummers, like, somebody might get half a dozen turns before you get one. But it does work its way around to everybody, I think.
It's not your gig if it's not your gig. I mean, that's a realization that I think everybody needs to at some point, you know, you'd stay with it long enough, you tend to realize that if so-and-so got the gig over you, it wasn't meant for you. You might think, oh, I was the most qualified. Oh, but I should have gotten that gig. It's it wasn't meant for you because you don't have that gig.
Right.
It's not yours. You didn't get the gig. Therefore, it's not meant for you. So shut up about that. Move on. There will be more things. You know, what we put out into the universe will always come back to us, but never in a way that we intend or predict. So it's just like, keep putting stuff out and like, keep going. I mean, a phrase that I like to use a lot is, and I've taught this in clinics a lot too, is you got to stay in the pool long enough. Yeah. We all know the feeling of jumping into a swimming pool, right? I mean, there's other, you know, metaphors for this sort of thing too. But one I like is like, everybody knows the feeling of jumping into a swimming pool. It's cold. Holy shit. Like, it's uncomfortable and it shocks our body and stuff. Cause you know, but you know, you could either, you know, dip a toe in before you jump and all that anxiety is, you know, building up of like, oh my God, it's going to be cold. Mm-hmm. But as soon as you jump into the pool and forget all that, jump in the pool as soon as you think, and then you stay in the pool long enough, your body starts warming up and it's like, oh, this isn't that bad. And then you realize, oh, I just needed to stay in long enough.
But
some pools are really cold. You know, like Steve Harvey's example was, everybody's got to jump. There's that speech that he gives, you know, everybody, you know, is at the precipice of their lives and they've got to jump, you know, in order to succeed. But, you know, before your parachute opens, you know, you're going to fall down. You're going to get scraped up. You're going to get bruised pretty badly, but eventually your parachute has to open. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the thing. Like Carbon would say, go on to where you're going and let the world catch up to you. And if you stop going where you're going, the world will pass you by. It's basically saying like, if you don't quit, you have to succeed at some point. That's just law. Right.
Yeah.
Not only will you succeed, but you have to. You have to? Are you kidding? Mm-hmm.
Right.
You have to. At some point, if you don't quit, you have to succeed. So, you know, screw gigs that you didn't get because that's just wasted energy. Like, just keep going. Keep going and do stuff that you like. Find different ways to amuse yourself and, you know, keep growing, and then eventually something has to happen.
Right. And when it comes to gigs that you didn't get, like it took me way longer to come to grips with this than it should have, because it's so fucking basic and so fucking obvious. But in, you know, I went through this period, especially when I was in LA, of the gig envy. Like, why did he get that gig? I could do that gig. Why didn't I get called for that gig? And it you know, it finally dawned on me that it's about relationships. I was like, he got that gig because he has a relationship with so-and-so. They've been playing together forever. You don't even know so-and-so. That guy doesn't know your name or face. Like, you were never anywhere near consideration for that gig in the first place. A.
Yeah.
B. What have you done to create that kind of relationship that opens up that kind of opportunity for you? Not shit. So,
the people that walk through doors confidently have gone out to do things. Like, you just gotta, like, my mantra, this is my ongoing mantra, it's go, do, be, and have. And it's in that order for a very specific reason, because most people have it backwards. Most people think you have to have money or status or even relationships in order to be somebody and then to do things to go somewhere. But I flip that around. It's like, no, you have to go and do what you set, go where you need to go, do what you set out to do. And then you can become the person that you'd set out to be and have whatever it is that comes your way. So all of that is very much in that order. So those who walk through those doors confidently have gone out and done their homework. They've done the work. You know, you can't get anywhere in this industry without some serious shedding, some serious work. You got to put in the work for that. And those people that walk through the door, that's their door. And, you know, it's, another Carvinism is, before you beg, be prepared to receive. You know, so if you're if you're begging for a gig that you really, really want, you best be damn sure that you did your homework in order to be prepared for that. Because, you know, you be careful what you ask for, sort of thing.
And that you reminded me of something else that a bass player buddy of mine said, a great bassist named Kelly McCarty in Atlanta. And he was talking about just the nature of confidence as a player. And he was like, you know, there's the kind of confidence that comes from ego, right? If you just think you're the shit all the time. There's the kind of confidence that comes from positive reinforcement, you know, people telling you you're the shit, whether it's true or not. But he said, there is nothing like the confidence that comes from knowing you've done the work.
Earned confidence. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. And when you talk about, you know, people who walk through doors confidently, you know, not only do they walk into a situation, you know, whether it's an audition or a new gig or whatever, like they can, you know, they walk into that situation knowing they can handle their shit. But the other thing that comes with that is the confidence that they know if it doesn't work out, it's cool. Like,
I'll
there are other doors for me to walk through. I will walk through them confidently as well. And, you know, whether or not this works out is not going to make or break my confidence.
But I'm showing up. I did the work. And if it wasn't meant for me, it wasn't meant for me. That's not my gig. On to the next. Keep going. Carvin would say, let's roll our sleeves up. Let's get our hands dirty and make our dreams come true.
Another great Carvinism. You've got way more than me. But but on this tip, There was a time in Kansas City when I was pretty well established there, and this great drummer named Brandon Draper moved to town. I interviewed him a while back, and I got heady as fuck about all the gigs Brandon Draper was gonna, you know, he was gonna steal all my gigs, and of course that didn't end up happening. He just created a shitload of gigs for himself that didn't exist before. But I was talking to Carvin just about this insecurity, and Carvin said, don't worry about him. Don't worry. Like, what he said, whatever he's doing is none of your business. And I'd never thought about it that way before. He's like, it's none of your business. Your business is your path, your goals. You know, whatever he's doing has no effect on how you walk your path. It's none of your business.
You're wasting your time and your own happiness by worrying about other people and what they're doing. So just keep going. You just got to keep going. That's it. Stay in the pool long enough.
Well, you keep going on that tour, man. Safe travels. Take care of yourself.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, it was great to talk to you, man.
Hey, thanks for having me on this. I've been a fan of this podcast for a while. So, you know, the fact that you asked me, I'm just very humbled. So thank you very much, man.
Absolutely, man. Great to have you.
Thanks, dude.
There you go, Tom Jorgensen. Thanks again to him for hanging. Beetlejuice still has lots of dates in lots of cities. Plenty of chances to catch it. Check out BeetlejuiceBroadway.com for all that. Next week, Matt Krause will be talking with Yamil Conga. Originally from Puerto Rico, now living and working in Nashville, his work includes touring with country artist Frank Ray and lecturing on Afro-Cuban music. Hope you check that out. Until then, stay safe, stay sane, play pretty, and thanks for listening. Cheers.